Vrindavan Dhamma ki jai.
Jai.
Mathura Dhamma ki jai.
Jai.
Navadvip Mayapur Dhamma ki jai.
Jai.
Jagannath Puri Dhamma ki jai.
Jai.
Jamuna Devi ki jai.
Bhakti
ki jai. Tulsi Maharani ki jai.
Jai.
Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda ki jai.
Jai.
Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees.
Hare Krishna.
All glories to the assembled devotees.
Hare
Krishna.
All glories to the assembled devotees.
Hare Krishna.
All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Krishnaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namine. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharani Nirvasesa Sinyavadi Paskacharya Satarani Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatam Vikams Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvijitam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Param Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vikamscha Panchakapa Tribhishcha Kripa Sindhavi Avatapa Tutunam Pavanevya Vaishnavi Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om
Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
It's September 7th, 2015, Skype class over Hilo, Hawaii, and reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 5, Vidura's Talks with Maitreya, Text 46. Paneyate Deva Kata Suhaya.
Paneyate Deva Kata Sudaya.
Pravrida Bhaktya Vishadasaya Te Ye.
Pravrida Bhaktya Vishadasaya Te Ye.
Vairagya Saram Prati Labdha Bodham.
Vairagya Saram Prati Labdha Bodham.
Yatanjanasviyurakuntadishnam. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. O Lord, persons who, because of their serious attitude, attain the stage of enlightened devotional service, achieve the complete meaning of renunciation and knowledge, and attain the Vaikuntha Loka in the spiritual sky, simply by drinking the nectar of your topics. Purport. The difference between the impersonalistic mental speculators and the pure devotees of the Lord is that the former pass through a miserable understanding of the absolute truth at every stage, whereas the devotees enter into the kingdom of all pleasures even from the beginning of their attempt. The devotee has only to hear about devotional activities, which are as simple as anything in ordinary life, and he also acts very simply, whereas the mental speculator has to pass through a jugglery of words which are partially facts and partially a make-show for the maintenance of an artificial impersonal status. In spite of his strenuous efforts to attain perfect knowledge, the impersonalist attains merging into the impersonal oneness of the Brahma-jyoti of the Lord, which is also attained by the enemies of the Lord, simply because of their being killed by him. The devotees, however, attain to the highest stage of knowledge and renunciation and achieve the Vaikuntha Lokas, the planets in the spiritual sky. The impersonalist attain only the sky and does not achieve any tangible transcendental bliss, whereas a devotee attains to the planets where real spiritual life prevails. With a serious attitude, the devotee throws away all achievements like so much dust, and he accepts only devotional service, the transcendental culmination. Panena te deva kata sudhaya pravrida bhaktya vishadasaya te ye. Vairagya saram pratilabdha bodham yatan jasan viryur akunta dishnam. O Lord, persons who, because of their serious attitude, attain the stage of enlightened devotional service, achieve the complete meaning of renunciation and knowledge, and attain the Vaikuntha Loka in the spiritual sky, simply by drinking the nectar of your topics. So this verse is very connected with the verse previously, where the demigods said that one whose internal vision is open transcendentally enjoys the Lord's activities. And here they are explaining that such persons also attain to Vaikuntha Loka and enjoy drinking those activities. So Jiva Goswami and Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur and here Srila Prabhupada all are referencing this verse and the next verse in terms of the difference between the personalistic and the impersonalistic path, that the demigods here are glorifying the path of hearing the Lord's activities, drinking the Lord's activities. And Srila Prabhupada makes the point here that the devotee has only to hear about devotional activities, which are as simple as anything in ordinary life, and the devotees enter into the kingdom of all pleasures even from the beginning of their attempt. So one of the symptoms of being actually on the bhakti path rather than on another path is that it is the kingdom of all pleasures even from the beginning. Keval Ananda Kanda. Now there are many reasons why persons who take up spiritual life either fail to progress or progress very slowly. And one that is emphasized often among the followers of Srila Prabhupada is offenses. And this was certainly referred to, the concept of offenses being a block was referred to in the previous purport. But here we see a different possible cause, and that is that one is not purely on the bhakti path. If one is indeed performing bhakti yoga, then one should have the kingdom of all pleasures even from the beginning of the attempt. Keval Ananda Kanda. If a person is seeing that, well, my path, my spiritual path is simply renunciation, it's dry, there's no pleasure in it, then it's possible that one is on the right path but committing offenses, but it's also possible that one is on a different path. There's a place where Srila Prabhupada says that if one is eating, one will gain nourishment except for two possibilities. The first is that one is not actually eating at all. And the second is that one is actually eating, but there are some sort of parasites in one's digestive tract that's stealing the nutrition. So the parasites in the digestive tract are compared to offenses. And of course, offenses are quite common. They're probably more common than we would like to think. I mean, just recently I ran into occasions of dealing with two devotees who, in the context and the intention of preaching Krishna consciousness, were offending large groups of people. And they were offending seriously practicing devotees among those large groups of people. Their language, their tone, etc., was very derogatory, and they were relishing the fact that other people were offended. They were enjoying offending people and hurting their feelings and denigrating them publicly, all in the name of teaching truth. So these persons are not aware that they're committing an offense. If you told them, you know, this is offensive, they wouldn't see it. They'd say, well, I'm just teaching truth. And there's so many of the offenses, not only offenses against devotees, which are, of course, the most serious, offenses against the scriptures, offenses against the guru, offenses against the name in terms of not having complete faith in the name, maintaining material attachments. So many of these offenses are very subtle, and I've seen in my own devotional life that many, many times I'm committing these offenses in the guise of service. So with a justification, as Prabhupada puts it, that Arjuna was using Krishna consciousness to avoid Krishna consciousness. And I've seen this phenomena both in my own life and in the lives of many others. So we don't want to minimize the fact that offenses may be a block, and that offenses, the 10 offenses to the holy name and offenses to the deities or to the Dham, may be a major factor in our difficulty. But in this particular context of today's verse, we want to look at something else. We want to look at whether or not we are actually on the bhakti path at all. Because even if one is offenseless, if one is performing mixed bhakti or if one is performing another kind of yoga, then one's path is going to be very difficult. So let's look a little bit at these two paths. Of course, another place with which we may be very familiar where these two paths are elucidated is in the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, particularly verse 5, but the first few verses of the 12th chapter. And the question Arjuna asked there is completely relevant to today's and tomorrow's verse, where he asks, what's better, Krishna, to engage in bhakti from the very beginning, or to first realize the self and then engage in bhakti? So Arjuna, certainly at this point in the Bhagavad Gita, after the 10th and 11th chapter, particularly chapter 9, very much with devotional service, he's decided that he wants to engage in bhakti, but he's not sure whether or not he needs some prior qualification. Does he need a prerequisite that first he realizes the self? You know, should he go up through the yoga ladder to bhakti, essentially? Or should he go directly? So then Krishna takes some time to elucidate the difference between these. So first of all, the goal is different. As Srila Prabhupada explains in today's purport, the goal that the impersonalists achieve is simply merging into the sky. They just want to become one with the Lord's effulgence, or sometimes they want to become one with the body of the Lord. And therefore they achieve the same result as the demons that are killed by the Lord. And they should consider that if this is a result achieved by demons who are killed by the Lord, it's probably not the best thing. Right? That the Lord's not going to give the best thing to the demons that he kills. So I think that most of us on the bhakti path do not have merging into the Brahmajyoti as our goal. Although I have met some, you know, initiated, fully practicing persons in Gaudiya Sampradaya who really do truly have this as their goal. And in fact, I was speaking with one of my god sisters some time ago, and she said, you know, I was an impersonalist when I joined, and I really tried to become a personalist. I really tried. I tried to become convinced by Prabhupada's philosophy, but my inner desire is still just to merge with the light. I don't want to have any kind of position in the spiritual world. She said, I don't even want to be a blade of grass in the spiritual world. I don't even want to have shantarasa. I just simply want to merge with the light, even after so many decades of practice. That's my desire. So that may be there in some cases, but generally I see that people who take up the path of bhakti, that's not what they want. They want loving service to Shyamasundara. They want to enter Goloka Vrindavan. They want to enter a world of variety. Of course, we may have some hesitancy about variety. Right? Like someone asked the question just a few days ago, well, aren't we all going to see exactly the same Krishna because Prabhupada's giving us the Krishna? Aren't we going to see the Krishna that Prabhupada's describing, and isn't that going to be the same for all of us? So there's still some hesitancy about variety. There's still some hesitancy about personality, even in those of us who ostensibly say that what we're looking for totally is the variety of Goloka Vrindavan. But let's assume that we do want the goal a variety of service, and we don't just want to merge. Let's assume that we do want that goal. Although, as I say, some people may not. Some people may have a goal of merging, a goal of liberation, perhaps consciously aware of it, or perhaps not consciously aware of it. And certainly the difference is one that is explained so many times by Srila Prabhupada. I think we can just touch on it, that as Prabhupada says in today's verse, that they have no real bliss, that the people who attain the Brahmajyoti, they're not experiencing the full bliss, just simply merging with the light. You're experiencing, in fact, only eternality. Even full knowledge is not available. It's just like that old hippie book, Be Here Now. You know, that's all it is. So that just to be here now is, you know, it's nicer than material misery, undoubtedly. But it's not what we're really hankering for. All right, what is the difference in the process of bhakti and the process of other impersonalistic forms, which are generally karma yoga, gyan yoga, or jnan yoga, all of which can be part of bhakti? But the process in and of themselves is generally more or less impersonalistic. So the process of bhakti, as explained in the 12th chapter, text 2, is maya vesya mano, fix your mind on Krishna, shraddhaya, with faith. So the essence of the path of bhakti, and I believe that the essence of the path of bhakti is very commonly misunderstood, whereas the goal of bhakti is rarely misunderstood, or misunderstood only in subtle aspects, that one resists the concept of variety on a subtle platform. But on the gross platform, anyone who takes up bhakti understands the goal is Vrindavan, or Vaikuntha, rather, as the today's verse says, and Vaikuntha, rather than the goal of just the Brahmajyoti. But the process is often misunderstood. Because the process has activities of the body, words, and mind, the process is sometimes misunderstood as simply activities of the body, or simply activities of the body and words, and not activities of the body, words, and mind. And of the three, the activities of the mind are the most important. So bhakti is primarily an activity of the mind, of the thinking, feeling, and willing, of thoughts, emotions, and desires, and frankly, the activities of the body and the words are secondary. For example, somebody who was paralyzed and with a tube down their throat, who could not engage their physical body in any acts, nor could they engage their words in any acts, could certainly still be engaged in bhakti, in the mind. However, a person who's engaging just with the body and the words, but not with the mind, is not actually engaged in bhakti. So certainly all are important, and in fact, they're all very connected. We will tend to do what we think about, and we will tend to think about what we do. So engaging the body in acts of devotion is not unimportant. In fact, we could say that it is essential. However, it is not the essence. So it is essential, but it is not the essence. It is essential only because otherwise we will engage our bodies and words in acts of non-devotion, and then fixing our mind on Krishna will be almost impossible. So I'm sure that most of us have experienced this phenomena, that if we speak about, you know, materialistic things, and if we do materialistic things, our ability to think of Krishna is greatly compromised. So really the activities of the body and the activities of the speech are to facilitate the engagement of the mind, thinking of Krishna in a favorable way to please Krishna and with faith. And then externally with the body, always engage in the worship of Shamasunda Nitya Yukta Upasate, always engaged. And Prabhupada says that as far as the body, he says whatever work one does is done for Krishna. The devotee does not desire any achievement other than pleasing the Supreme Personality of Godhead. His life's mission is to please Krishna. Prabhupada says sometimes he chants, sometimes he hears or reads books about Krishna. Sometimes he cooks prasadam or goes to the marketplace to purchase something for Krishna. Or sometimes he washes the temple or the dishes. Whatever he does, he does not let a single moment pass without devoting his activities to Krishna. Such action is in full samadhi. So that is the process. The process is from the very beginning of bhakti to dedicate one's actions to Krishna's pleasure. So bhakti begins with a personal relationship between me, the devotee person, and Krishna, the Supreme Person. And because Krishna is very sweet, that process is very sweet from the beginning. And I thought I would contrast this process with the process done by the Jains, particularly the Jain monks and nuns. And it was interesting. I had two occasions to research Jainism. One is many years ago in London, we were putting together a curriculum resource for the Krishnamurti schools of celebrating Vaishnav holidays. And the directors wanted the children also to have some knowledge of holidays outside of our tradition. So we included some non-Vaishnava Hindu holidays like Durga Puja, and we included some Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist and Jain holidays. And the main reason we did that is in the UK, the government mandates that all children in all schools learn something about all the major religions that are being practiced in the country. So I ended up doing quite a lot of research for Jainism. on the Mahavir's birthday and in his life and what was his process, the 13 years that he did before he apparently attained impersonal realization. And just recently I was doing some research on vows, vrats, and the term vrat is also used by the Jains. So I ended up coming to some information about what the Jain aesthetics, the nuns and monks, do for their vows. And of course the grihasthas also take vows, but of a little lesser severity. So these Jain vows are five: non-violence, truth, non-stealing, celibacy, and non-attachment. So in non-violence, of course, you find that many of the Jain monks and nuns, they use, they keep a cloth over their nose and mouth, and they filter their water, and so forth. And I think that we have a similar vow in Krishna consciousness, although we don't take it that extreme. You know, they say that the minimum killing of the lowest form of life should be the only thing that's allowed. And they have a nice explanation of the different forms of life. And I think, again, we would agree with this in bhakti, because Jainism said it's not the actual harm, but it's the intention to harm. So the absence of compassion. And certainly this, we would agree with that part of the process. Then their next vow is truth. So Jainism also says that one should speak truth which should be wholesome and pleasant, and should refrain, should be silent if the truth causes pain, hurt, anger, or the death of any living being. So again, this would also be part of our process, of the five austerities of speech. And it says that truth should be observed in speech, mind, and deed. One should not utter an untruth, ask others to do so, or approve of such activities. Then non-stealing. So they define stealing as taking another's property without their consent by unjust or immoral methods. Not taking anything which was not belong to him. You cannot take anything that may be lying unattended or unclaimed. Not even touching a worthless thing that does not belong to you. When taking alms, not taking more than what's minimally needed. Otherwise, that is also theft. And one should not steal, ask others to do so, or approve of such activity. So we have certainly such injunctions in the Nectar of Instruction purport and in other places. Then under celibacy or chastity, now here they take this to a very extreme position, where they say that not only should one be totally celibate in body and also in mind, not even thinking of the pleasures of sexuality, but also not enjoying any pleasure of any of the five senses. Not enjoying it oneself, not asking others to enjoy any sensual pleasure, and not approving of any sensual pleasure, although there's some allowance for householders to have some very limited sensual pleasures. And here I'm seeing a divergence from the impersonal path to the personal path. So among these impersonalists, they're saying you are not allowed to look at anything beautiful or hear anything pleasing or smell anything pleasing or taste anything pleasing. And they define celibacy as avoidance of any sort of sensory enjoyment by any of the senses. Now one can say, well, in bhakti we also deny all gratification of the senses. It's one of our primary tenets, to avoid all sense gratification. But I remember when my father first visited a temple, and he said, although you all talk about denying sense gratification, he says your temple is full of sensory enjoyment. He noted the real flowers decorating the altar, and he was saying, you know, generally in the West, at least, only very wealthy people are going to have real flowers decorating their house in such profusion at all times. I mean, in India it's rather common, but in some other places perhaps. But in most of the world it's quite uncommon, right? A dozen roses costs a fortune, practically. What to speak of having, you know, roses and gardenias and etc., etc., everywhere. And it was interesting yesterday at Vyas Puja, I was passing around the flowers for Pushpanjali, and when I tried to give some to my 2-year-old grandson, he just came up to smell them because he's used to flowers being passed around after the arti to smell. And that's what we're doing, right? We smell the flowers that have been offered to Krishna. We see the beauty of the deity We taste the food that has been offered to Krishna. We hear the melodious kirtan. I mean, we're really exulting in satisfaction of our senses, but not directly. So we define sense gratification as trying to satisfy our senses directly, and bhakti, as Prabhupada nicely explains in that lecture on the nectar devotion, as trying to satisfy our senses through Krishna, enjoying our senses as Krishna enjoys them, enjoying Krishna's enjoyment, enjoying what Krishna has enjoyed and enjoying Krishna's enjoyment. And here's a major, major divergence between the impersonal path and the personal path. And today's verse talks about vairagya, renunciation, but the renunciation of the devotee on the personal path is so markedly different from that of the impersonal path. The impersonal path is saying, don't have any pleasure in the world at all. And of course, the impersonal path, what kind of pleasure are you having internally? You know, you're not even having really any internal pleasure. In effect, you're trying to live without pleasure. That such is a very unnatural position for the soul, which is one of Srila Prabhupada's main points in the 12th chapter of the Gita. The soul is anandamaya vyasat. The soul is naturally very happy. So this impersonal path is running counter not only to our material inclinations, which is difficult enough, as I think most of us have experienced, but is also running counter to our spiritual nature. So there's nothing to support it. It's a very artificial position. You know, it's like if someone's trying to do something against their nature, which is one of the main points of the Bhagavad Gita, that you cannot act contrary to your nature. It won't stand. Your nature will reassert itself in some way or another. And the soul's inclination to enjoy is so strong that the impersonalists struggle much, much more than those in bhakti yoga. And they really run the risk of having a hardened heart, of some kind of fall down, or of trying to take pleasure in some subtle way which they don't even understand that they're doing or admit to themselves. And it's a very unpleasant path. All right, then the last vow of the Jain monks is non-attachment, non-possession, aparigraha, which is, of course, also mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita and is something that Krishna mentions as those who are very dear to him. So the Jain monks talk about that giving up all attachment to any material things, such as wealth, property, grains, house, books, clothes, etc., to any relationships, such as father, mother, spouse, children, friends, enemies, other monks, disciples, etc., to any pleasure of the five senses, touch, taste, smell, sight, and hearing, and to any feelings, pleasure and painful, pleasurable and painful feelings towards any objects, equanimity towards music and noise, good and bad smells, soft and hard objects for touch, beautiful and dirty sights, not eating food for taste but only for survival, and observing this in speech, mind, and deed, not possessing anything, not asking others to possess anything, and not approving of anybody else possessing anything. And again, that may appear to be the same thing that is given many, many times in the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavatam for the bhakti yogis. But Srila Prabhupada, on talking about the devotee's non-possession of anything and non-attachment to anything, says that the devotees should possess Krishna. They should be able to say, Krishna is mine. And Prabhupada makes the point that without having Krishna as one's possession, one is not able to give up all other possessions. So again, the impersonalists are trying to give up everything and leave a nothingness, because that's what they want. They want to become nothingness. So that's what they are practicing. But how is one going to be satisfied with nothingness? The devotee's satisfaction is because they are full. So if you think of the difference this way, one person is being asked to be satisfied by fasting, and another person is being asked to be satisfied by eating a full meal. Now, yesterday after the Vyas Puja feast, if someone had asked me to eat anything else, like my granddaughter here had made gulab jamuns for Janmashtami, she offered that I could have some, But after the Vyaspurja feast, I wasn't interested in eating anything, not even a tiny drop of a gulabjamun, because I was full. So the detachment achieved in bhakti yoga is because of being full. This is what Dhruva Maharaj explains. I've become full, and therefore I'm naturally detached. Whereas on the impersonal path, one tries to become detached by being empty, by taking pleasure in the emptiness. And, you know, there's not much pleasure in the emptiness. And just sitting in the middle of the Sahara Desert alone, looking at the sky. I mean, you know, how much pleasure is that? How many human beings desire to live such a life? It's contrary to our very nature. And the nature of the path is also indicated, or the process rather, is also indicated in today's verse when the demigods talk about drinking, right? Panena. They talk about drinking the Lord's topics. So we shouldn't think that being absorbed in the Lord's pastimes and absorbing our senses in the Lord's enjoyment is like material enjoyment. But it is something that one is really relishing. And this term drinking the topics. Of course, such is also earlier in the Bhagavatam, in the second canto, in the verse that Jiva Goswami identifies as the final verse of the Bhagavatam, although it's in the second canto, one of the most important verses in the Bhagavatam. Pibantiye bhagavata atmana satam katam mritam shravana puteshu sambhutam punantite vishaya vidusita swayam vajanti tach charana saro ruhantikam. Those who drink through oral reception, fully filled with the nectarian message of Lord Krishna, the beloved of the devotees, purify the polluted aim of life known as material enjoyment and thus go back to Godhead, to the lotus feet of Him, the personality of Godhead. So it's almost identical to today's verse, where if you want to attain to the spiritual world, you become absorbed in the spiritual topics and you become absorbed in relishing the topics. And then that's the process. We talked about the difference in the goal, the difference in the process. Then the nature of the path, as Prabhupada explains in today's purport, is that it's joyful from the beginning. Baladeva Dibhushan says that even though the devotees endure difficulty in withdrawing their senses from objects other than Krishna, and in engaging in the various angas of bhakti, they do not experience the same suffering as the impersonalists because of the dazzling attraction of Krishna's blissful form. So yes, there is definitely difficulty even in bhakti. Prabhupada says, until we come to nishtha, it's a hard struggle with determination. Now, I mean, there's no doubt about it that anyone who says that bhakti is easy hasn't really done bhakti, because bhakti does involve changing one's very long-term and deeply embedded bad habits of trying to enjoy separately from Krishna. But one should be replacing those bad habits with the good habit of being absorbed in Krishna. And therefore the suffering is mitigated, and one is also filled with great happiness, whereas the impersonalists are only doing the negative. Another difference in the nature of the path, which isn't really so much addressed in today's verse, but is still worth mentioning, is that you don't need any previous qualification to engage in bhakti, as was explained, I believe, in yesterday's verse. Yes, in yesterday's verse, Prabhupada was talking in the purport about Magrari the hunter and Nalakuvera and Manigriva. So to engage in bhakti, you don't need any kind of qualification. You can be completely in the mode of ignorance and go from there directly to bhakti. Whereas on the impersonal path, if you don't have a high level of previous qualification, you just can't do it. It's so difficult, it's so contrary to the nature of the soul that, you know, if you're not a very, very pious and qualified person already, you just can't do it. You know, it's not like anybody can become an Olympic gymnast or Olympic swimmer. You know, you have to be qualified even just to get into the training programs. You know, you can't just become a symphony musician without some previous aptitude. So it's like that for impersonalism. And not only is the process itself really arduous and contrary to our nature, but most people in the modern day just don't have the qualification for it at all. And they engage in a parody of of the impersonal path. They engage in a parody of karma yoga, jnana yoga, and dhyana yoga. You know, they sit in the middle of London in some yoga studio and pretend to meditate on the void. And then at night they go out, you know, drinking and engaging in illicit sex. So this is, it's not going to work. It's not going to work. Whereas Srila Prabhupada said, even the drunkard can meditate on Krishna as the taste of his liquor and eventually become a saintly person. And such is not available to those on these other yoga paths. Then the deliverance. So Krishna personally delivers the devotee. And knowledge and renunciation are given as byproducts of bhakti. And the impersonal path, you have to cultivate knowledge and detachment. But to the devotee, all they have to do is cultivate attachment to Krishna, who's the all-attractive, and knowledge and detachment naturally follow without much endeavor for the devotee. And the devotee is delivered by Krishna. The impersonalists have to be so careful about all their circumstances, you know, and as Krishna explains in the 8th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, when they're going to die and so forth and so on. But the devotee doesn't have to be concerned like that. You know, whether the devotee dies in an accident or while preaching in the West, or the devotee dies at Govardhan Hill, it doesn't really matter because Krishna's delivering the devotee. The devotee doesn't have to make these sort of external arrangements. Nor is the devotee, in impersonalism, the jiva is going by their own determination and their own strength, whereas the devotee doesn't need to depend on their own determination and their own strength. All they need to depend on is their extent of attraction to Krishna. And then Krishna uses his determination and his strength to pull up the devotee. And the devotee becomes, as Prabhupada says, throws away all achievements like so much dust. So the devotee has such a wonderful thing that everything the impersonalists are striving with great effort to achieve, the devotee thinks is just a pile of dust and has no real interest in. So if we find that our progress is very dry, yes, there will be a hard struggle with determination until nistha, but first of all, nistha shouldn't take 40 years. That's the first thing we should say. But even if until attaining the stage of nistha, one is finding that not only is it a hard struggle with determination, but it's very dry, then one may not be fully on the bhakti path. There may be some contamination of the goal, of the process, of the nature of the path, of one's idea of deliverance and qualification. There may be some covering with the processes of karma, gyan, and jnana. So these are the two areas that we should look to if we're experiencing this kind of dryness, is offenses, but also the nature of the path that we're on. If we're truly in bhakti, then even in the anartha nivritti stage, even in that hard struggle with determination, we should still find ourselves drinking the nectar of the Lord's activities. I think it's sort of an interesting point to say as a side issue, but in closing, is that the nature of bhakti and the nature of the path is not only known to Gaudiya Vaishnavas. We find that people in all genuine traditions of bhakti, all genuine traditions where they're speaking of a love and devotion to the Supreme Lord, they all describe that although there's a period of hard struggle with determination, there's a dark night of the soul, there's a wasteland that one has to go through, however they describe it. They also say that even in that time, even going through that time, there is a sweetness if one's process is that of love and devotion to the Lord. And if one doesn't find that sweetness, one should look at these two possible causes, either offensives or being on the wrong path. And I think that often among the Gaudiya Vaishnavas, the stress is laid to on offenses. And sometimes that's not what's really the problem. Or sometimes there's a combination of these two problems. Bhakti is keval ananda kanda. And it should be something that we are relishing, even if we are the grossest neophytes. So questions, comments?
You mentioned that the hard struggle sort of subsides at the stage of nishta. Could you speak a little bit about the stage of nishta?
Yeah, sure. I would say that the hard struggle almost entirely subsides at the stage of nishta. That doesn't mean that there's no more endeavor, but the endeavor has stopped being a hard struggle. Let's look at some analogies. So if you've ever become expert at any material skill, my daughter teaches Bharat Natyam dance, so she still has to practice. She did a lot of dances for Janmashtami, and she was practicing, and it was hard work, and we had some unusually hot and sticky weather here, so, it was sweaty. It was hard, sweaty work. But it wasn't the same kind of struggle that her beginning students go through. I mean, I was watching one of the beginning students dancing at Janmashtami, and you could see that this beginner was very concentrated on where do I put my feet and where do I put my hands? What do I do with my body? They're concentrated on the mechanics of the dance, whereas those who have passed that stage, they're concentrating on the mood and the offering to Krishna entirely. The mechanics have become automatic to them. I mean, even in mathematics, years ago, as a Gurukul teacher, there was one textbook that we liked to use for mathematics, and they advertised that their method fostered what they called automaticity, where the mechanics of mathematics became automatic. And, this is true in any skill that we learn materially. Driving a car. When I'm driving a car, the mechanics of driving a car, as long as I'm not in a place like the UK, are automatic. I know when to shift the gears on the manual, I know when to put on the brakes and when to turn, and if I'm driving to someplace familiar, even the path is automatic. And it doesn't mean that I'm not making any effort, I'm still making an effort to drive the car. It's not that the car is driving automatically in the sense that I sit in the seat and close my eyes, but I'm not focusing on the mechanics of it. In fact, I'm not even very aware of the mechanics of it. We often run into what's called the curse of knowledge when somebody who's at the automatic platform is trying to teach somebody who's still absorbed with the mechanics. And the person on the automatic platform forgets what are the intermediate steps that one has to go through. So at nishta, one is no longer concerned with the mechanics of what they're doing. The mechanics are automatic. And the particularly fixing the mind on Krishna has become the default value. So at nishta, the mind still wanders from Krishna. It's not that the mind doesn't wander from Krishna at nishta, but bringing it back to Krishna is the default value. And it happens rather quickly and without much effort. That the devotee just makes a small amount of effort and the mind is brought back to Krishna. And the same with the words and the body, that the body is just naturally engaged in serving Krishna without having to, how do I engage my, what do I do? Is this for Krishna? Is that for Krishna? It's just there. And the same with the words. If one starts speaking in a material way, one immediately becomes aware of it and adjusts it. And before nishta, it's not like that. Before nishta, one can be deep into illusion without even realizing it, and it can go on and on for weeks or months before one corrects it and so forth. Bhaktivedanta Swami gave a nice analogy that he says, before nishta, it's like one has some great highs and deep lows in bhakti. When one's going up and down these hills, he says, but at nishta, when one doesn't have the highs in bhakti, it's more like one's flat. One doesn't have these big dips anymore. Another way of explaining it is given in the first canto of the Bhagavatam, is that one is basically in the mode of goodness. One feels the symptoms of the mode of goodness. One feels this happiness and knowledge and detachment and so forth. Another symptom of nishta, because of this happiness and knowledge, is that one becomes very hesitant to engage in any politics or to join any factions, to criticize any devotees, which is often the, perverted pastime of those below nishta. Those people thinking that my group is better than yours, and I know the philosophy better than you, and therefore I'm a better person, and so forth and so on. It's not that none of that tendency remains at Nishta, but the devotee really arduously and carefully, painstakingly wants to avoid it. So at Nishta, one is really endeavoring to avoid offenses in bhakti. And it's explained by Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur and Srila Prabhupada that this stage of Nishta happens when half of one's anartas are removed. So they're still anartas, but they're no longer really impeding the devotee's progress. One is not at the destination. Another analogy you can think of is, you know, climbing to the top of a hill and then being able to run down or ride your bike down or sled down if you're from a snow climate. So that, you know, going to the top and then just gliding down. You're still on the journey and you're still making some effort and there's still some determination and there's still some endeavor involved. There's still some willpower involved. But it's basically not a climb anymore. It's just easy. And that's because of the absence of passion, ignorance, and the absence of the anartas and the offenses, at least halfway gone, so that the blockage is gone. And another difference is one's focus. So before Nista, you'll find that people are very focused on anarta nivritti because that's the stage they're in. They're in anarta nivritti. If they haven't even started anarta nivritti, they tend to be focused on the anartas and everybody else. So those in Adushraddha, Sadhusanga, and Vajranakriya tend to be focused on everyone else's anartas. In anarta nivritti, the person tends to be focused on their own anartas. But once they hit nishta, as Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati puts it, they tend to be focused on artha pravritti. So they tend to be focused on accenting and increasing and nourishing the ways in which they are attached to Krishna and in really focusing on Krishna. And such persons are not giving much attention to their anartas, because at that point they see that Krishna is cleansing them of anartas and they have faith that all their remaining anartas will be cleansed. Certainly they're aware of their anartas, which is feeding their humility and their dependence and their crying for Krishna, but their obsession, their absorption is in the positive rather than in the negative. So I hope that wasn't too long of an answer.
No, it's great. Yeah, maybe like the analogy of riding a bike up the hill, so the anarta nivritti is kind of like riding uphill, and nishta is more kind of like when it levels out, it gets kind of,
yes,
it's no longer a struggle. You hit the top of the hill, so for some time you're going nice and level. It's very easy. And then the future is then gradually, in the other further stages, is when we start going downhill.
Yes, that's very nice, because Ruchi and Ashakti would be just gliding downhill. And in Bhava and Ashakti, you're there. You've reached your destination. You know, Bhava, you could say you've reached your destination, you've entered into it, and you know, Prema, you're actually in your home. Like Bhava, you've entered into the city, and Prema, you've entered into the home. But yeah, Ruchi and Ashakti are like gliding down the hill. That's very nice. And Nishta is like you've reached the top of the hill. And having reached the top of the hill, you get a glimpse of your destination.
You know, nice.
You've achieved a platform where you have some idea, and you know, when you're going up the hill, sometimes you can see the destination because of the way the road curves. So you know, occasionally there's a curve in the road where you get a glimpse of your destination, but then it's just gone. Whereas once you're at Nista, you really see your destination from the top, and going downhill, you're seeing your destination more or less all the time.
You can also look back. Which is also very encouraging.
Yes.
You look back and say, oh my God, look where I was.
Yes.
Whoa, way down there.
Yes, and that's one of the reasons why the person at Nista is not so obsessed with their faults anymore.
Mm.
Because they look back and they see, you know, Krishna, it's working. I don't need to put all my energy into that anymore. It's working. And of course, there's going to be specific times when the Lord is going to say, okay, let's give some energy to this specific anarta. For sure, even at Nista, Ruchi, and Ashakti. But it's not the altogether general mood. I mean, I see this very clearly in the articles that are submitted. I've mentioned this before, to Back to Godhead. So, you know, we have some articles where 90% of it is negative and only 10% of it is positive. Mm. We have some articles that are just bashing all the materialists. You know, the whole article is just bashing others. Then you have these articles that are very introspective, but in a negative way. And then you have the articles that are introspective and hopeful in a positive way. And you see it very, very clearly. You know, if you really want to understand someone's mentality, the main way is by their speaking and their writing, where people tend to reveal themselves. So these stages are quite clear in reading how people preach, or noticing how people preach. And of course, the great acharyas like Srila Prabhupada, they include all these aspects in their preaching because they're preaching to people at all different levels. And the Shastra itself is like that. So the Shastra itself, it's, you know, bashing the materialists. It's looking introspectively, negatively, looking introspectively, positively, focusing on the Leela of the Lord. So all these stages are there in the Shastra because people at all these stages are going to be fixated on these different things. Of course, we want to, even for the beginners, we want to push them as much as we possibly can to attachment to Krishna and to meditating on Krishna as much as possible, because that's going to keep them on the bhakti path, and that's going to move them through the lower stages. It's going to move us through the lower stages very quickly, which is also quite wanted. To stay in the lower stages of bhakti for a long time is quite dangerous, because it is such a hard struggle with determination that if a person doesn't get out of that stage fairly quickly, the temptation to go back to material sense gratification will be very strong.
Great answer. Thank you so much.
Mother, I have a question.
Yes.
Hare Krishna. When you spoke about material attachments, you know, as one, you know, one of the 10 offenses, and as householders, you know, although we have a home or, you know, altars in our home, and we try to do things for Krishna, there's still that material attachment. You know, it's like it's really hard to get rid of that material attachment, and whether it's with the body, you know, oh, I'm getting old, I have the color of my gray hair, or I like to wear jewelry, or I'm going to put kajal on today, or, you know, it's we chant, we do all these things, but there's it still hangs on. It's unless you're in like a monk quiet in the forest, I'm this is my biggest struggle.
Well, first of all, being a monk quiet in the forest is not the solution, because many people have become monks quiet in the forest and then they go back to material life in a sinful way.
Mm-hmm.
So the householder ashram is there for most of us, for a large portion of our life, is the safest position, because one can engage in some of these activities without deviating from the path of bhakti. Whereas when you're a monk in the forest, if you want to put on nice clothes, you're finished. It's a fall down. When you're mm-hmm. a householder, if you put on nice clothes, it's not a fall down. So there is some adjustment in what is dharma according to one's varna and ashram, and that facility is there. Just becoming a monk in the forest isn't the solution. In fact, becoming a monk in the forest should be what's done because your material attachments are finished, not as a way to get free of your material attachments. It's more the symptom of accomplishment rather than a process. You know, there is some process for the child in the brahmachari ashram where detachment is actually a process. But the idea is that most of the people in the brahmachari ashram will become grahasthas. So it's a way of having them becoming grahasthas without falling into a deep, dark well of grihamedi life, rather than, okay, it's a lifelong process. And we've seen that very few people who take to the brahmachari ashram as a lifelong process do well at it. That's just our practical experience. because that's not really our bhakti process. That's really a gyan yoga, dhyan yoga, karma yoga process. That my process is to remove the external things from my life. You know, not have any nice clothes or nice food or anything like that. So our process is more as far as becoming detached, that only Krishna will save me. My body's not going to save me. My mind's not going to save me. My family members aren't going to save me. My house, my whatever, is not going to save me. Only Krishna will save me. Only Krishna is my shelter. And whatever I'm doing to please Krishna. I'm not doing because I think it's my shelter. So, you know, I mean, I know of devotees who have to dress very nicely for their service. But they're dressing nicely to please Krishna, not because they think that, well, if I dress nicely, then everybody will respect me, and then I'll have the shelter of good reputation, and that will save me from material miseries and bring me happiness. So it's subtle. Mm-hmm. It's a subtle difference, but one should be alert to that. And if something's not necessary to please Krishna, then one should gradually give it up. You know, I mean, if having a nice home is not necessary to please Krishna because of one's ashram or one's preaching or whatever, then one should give that up. But if having a nice home is necessary to please Krishna, then one should have a nice home. It depends. I mean, just like I have my little room here, and when I'm not here, it's used as a guest room. And there are many times in my absence when guests have stayed here, sometimes for a week or two. And so I've set up many things in the room that I don't need. I mean, some of them I never use at all. I mean, I have some things here that I just absolutely never use. But when guests come here, they use them. You know, and I just had some guests come recently, and they said, oh, it was very nice, but there were no bowls. You know, there were a couple plates, but there were no bowls, you know. And I heard that, and I went and got some bowls. So it's, you know, what's necessary for our service and to please Krishna, that depends on our situation. You know, like Prabhupada said, first dress, then address. So when I'm preaching over Skype, obviously it doesn't matter what I wear. But if I'm out preaching in the world, you know, you're preaching in a university, or then you don't want to be wearing some old gray torn clothes with matted hair.
I guess for me it's trying to find the balance, you know.
It's not really a balance that you're looking for. What you're looking for is totally, am I doing this to make Krishna smile?
Right.
You know, am I doing this for Krishna's service? Am I doing it to make Krishna smile? Am I doing it? I mean, even arranging for your material care in the world is also a kind of service. I mean, unless we're wanting to lie naked on the street in Vrindavan, which is not what Srila Prabhupada would want.
Right.
You know, there was that man that lay naked on the street by the Krishna Balaram tree for 30-something years until he recently died. But that isn't what Srila Prabhupada would Bhaktisiddhanta or Bhaktivinoda Thakura. That's not what they're telling us to do. It wouldn't be very good for, you know, what are Prabhupada's disciples and followers doing? Are they all lying naked all over? They're covering the streets of Vrindavan lying naked and waiting for people to feed them. I mean, that's a bona fide process in bhakti, but that's not what our gurus are telling us to do. It's not what our leaders are telling us to do. So if we're not going to do that, then there has to be some facility for our living. And that's according to our ashram and so forth. I mean, it wouldn't be appropriate to say, well, I'm going to give up all ways of maintenance and figure that the temple will maintain me. When I've been living in Grihastha on my own, you know, that's not a service. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you've been living in a temple ashram your whole life and working for the temple, to expect the temple to maintain you in your old age is reasonable. But if you've gone through the Grihastha ashram, you've had your own job, you've had your own house, even if you've been serving Krishna with every breath, still, it's expected that you have some other means of maintenance. Now, what that would be, Is that going to be, you know, that you have a pension? Is it going to be you live with your children? Is it going to be that, you know, you travel from place to place with a begging bowl or whatever it may be? You know, that's also our service. Now, if we think of that as our shelter, if we think, well, I'm going to work hard to get my pension and that's what's going to save me, then it's a material attachment. If you're thinking, I'm going to work hard and get a pension so I'm not a burden to the society and I can do my service freely without, you know, without anxiety, then that's a service. And that, we have to look into our heart. One way you can tell whether or not it's a service is if Krishna doesn't allow it, are you still going to be peaceful?
Right.
You know, if I have a facility for this and that and Krishna takes it away, am I going, oh, no, mm-hmm. my shelter's gone. Everything's gone. You know, if your husband dies, your kids die, all your clothes burn up in a fire and your house burns up in a fire and all the things that you arranged for your service to Krishna are gone. Mm-hmm. You know, is Krishna still your shelter? Or do you say, oh, now I'm not going to worship Krishna anymore. He took away all of my shelters. There's a nice story of Sachi Devi in this connection, which one can meditate on. So one time, young Lord Chaitanya, he asked his mother, can I please have a garland for worshiping the Ganga? And as typically a mother will say to her children, yes, in a minute. Right? It's a very typical response from the mother to the child. Yes, my dear child, but I'm busy right now. I'll get it for you in a moment. And as typical for a child, Lord Chaitanya said, I want it now. I don't want to wait. And he had a tantrum. Now, the Lord's tantrums are not like an ordinary child's tantrums. Like Prabhupada says, if Krishna's lusty, he's unlimitedly lusty. So when the Lord has a tantrum, he has an unlimited tantrum. And he destroyed the whole house. He destroyed all of the clay pots in which all of the food was stored, all the grains and all of the spices. He destroyed all of that. He destroyed the whole kitchen. In fact, he destroyed the walls of the house. He destroyed the house. And then again, like a child, he was exhausted from his tantrum. He lay down on the floor and went to sleep. Then when he got up, he saw that the house was demolished. And it's explained he felt a little embarrassed. And then Sachi Devi said to him, my dear Nimai, this is your house. If you want to enjoy the house, or if you want to enjoy the house by living in it, or if you want to enjoy the house by demolishing it, either one is fine because it's your house. So whatever gives you pleasure is my pleasure. If your pleasure comes from destroying it, that's fine. Sachi Mata did not think, this is my house, and this is my shelter, and now you destroyed my means of living. She didn't think like that at all. And then she said to him, but how will I serve you? Now that you've destroyed the house, I can't cook for you anymore. I've no means of taking care of you. And so what will I do? And then Lord Chaitanya went out and he came back with a large quantity of gold. And with this gold, Sachi Mata was able to buy everything to replace what the Lord had ruined. So this is some evidence of where our attachment is. Is our attachment to service or is our attachment to a false shelter? What do we do when they're disturbed? What do we do, you know, when our things are stolen or our investments don't work out or a family member dies? Or, you know, what do we do in those circumstances? How do we respond? Do we say, you know, Krishna, whatever you want. Mare Krishna Rake Ke, Rake Krishna Mare Ke. If you desire, if this is your happiness, then I accept. You know, or do we say, oh no, where are you, God? Why you don't love me anymore? Why should I worship you? You know, if you were really a good God, you'd be, you know, does that make sense?
Yes, Mataji, it does. Thank you very much.
Okay, anybody else? We could take one more.
Okay, I have a question.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Very well?
Yes, I can hear you.
Can be heard.
Okay. I think in one part of your talk you mentioned that Krishna, for the devotee, Krishna, he's there. We don't have to concern ourselves with the time of passing this world. Maybe I caught it that way. Or anyway, I've always had this question, and it's, you know, from the eighth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. There must be something to it, because Krishna's saying that those who know the Supreme Brahman, you know, pass in that certain time of the 6 months where the sun travels in the north. And Bhishma, who's one of the 12 Mahajans, he followed the system, even though Krishna himself was personally present at his passing. And he had a fixed meditation on Krishna. So, you know, it's interesting how it's there, but then it's not there.
Yeah, that is a good question, and I think this question applies not only to the time of death, but to everything in our life in terms of accepting what's favorable and rejecting what's unfavorable, which are two of the symptoms of surrender for the devotee. So we have a limited ability. We're one of the five factors of action. And we have some limited ability to choose and arrange the aspects of our life. And as far as our limited ability allows, we should choose what's favorable and reject what's unfavorable. But we're not dependent on that as our shelter. I mean, like here in my little room, I have a beautiful piece of furniture on which I have my altar. So, you know, I've made some effort to set up an altar. Years ago, I was able to build a little cabin, and I built it according to Vastu because I was building it from scratch. Here in this place, it was an add-on room, and we weren't able to do everything according to Vastu. I can't put my altar in this room in the northeast corner. It just wouldn't work. So there's, you know, what can you do, what can you not do? And if Krishna puts you in a Siberian labor camp where you can't have any altar and you can't have any prasadam and you can't have any books, I like to tell that story of Satchisuta, who left his body in a Siberian labor camp where he had none of the processes of bhakti externally were available to him. I mean, he was chanting 16 rounds at great risk, but he had nothing available to him, and still, by all symptoms, he attained the supreme destination. So the devotee is dependent on Krishna's delivering him, and part of his surrender is to accept whatever is favorable. So if it's possible within our power to die at a certain time, like Bhishma had that within his power, if we have within our power to die in a holy place, surrounded by devotees at an auspicious time, of course we should do that. You know, it's not that we're intentionally going to walk into a brothel or a bar to die. But, you know, if you're distributing Prabhupada's books in a bar when Krishna takes you, then that's Krishna. And we're not dependent on whether or not our circumstances are favorable. Our circumstances are not our shelter. It's not that I'm becoming Krishna conscious because of my circumstances. So it's again this subtle difference between doing my best according to the very, very limited capacity that I have to set up a favorable life at every moment, what to speak of at the time of death, and the fact that my shelter is not in the favorable circumstances that I set up. They're more my way of taking shelter of Krishna that rather than my shelter directly. And the difference is very subtle but very important. You know, I accept what's favorable as my way of surrendering to Krishna. But it's Krishna that's my shelter, not the favorable circumstances. I mean, perhaps you could think of it in mundane terms, that when there's love between, you know, romantic love between two people. So if they're really in love, it's not dependent on circumstances. Shah Jahan, who built the Taj Mahal out of love for his wife Mumtaz. So for a while, they were exiled from their kingdom. They were living in very difficult circumstances. But still he had so much intense love for his wife. His love for his wife wasn't dependent on being in a palace and buying her roses and diamonds and things like that. That was a way he could express love, but he wasn't dependent on that. So if we can choose favorable circumstances, we should. Otherwise, where is our love? If I have the ability to give Krishna gardenias and roses and instead I give him chrysanthemums, you know, where is my love? I've been in temples where on the temple property right outside the door are these beautiful, fragrant, fresh flowers, and they're going out and buying these chrysanthemums which are rotting and offering the deities rotting chrysanthemum garlands when out right outside the door roses and gardenias are growing. So that's not surrender. Surrender is I choose what's favorable in my environment. But you know, if you're up in Canada in the winter, then maybe the only flowers you can get are rotting chrysanthemums. And Krishna is your shelter, not the flowers. Is that all right?
Yes.
Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada. Gita.
Jai.